Hey, everybody. It's Obi from the Obi and Axe Show. Today, we have a very special guest. We have Steve Rader, Deputy Director for the Center of Excellence for Collaborative Innovation at NASA. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The people that you're dealing with are you know, you haven't dealt with a lot of these problems before. So how do you even know if you're right? How do you estimate the risk? How does that work?
Yeah, so for us, it's actually fairly easy because NASA has lots of really, really big risks and really hard problems to solve, right? Yeah. Otherwise, we would already be living on Mars, right? It's
exactly.
Doing it with all the constraints, right? We it's not that we can't do things. It's doing it with the budget we've got and with the technology we've got.
I see, yeah.
In a reasonable time frame and with all of the kind of ebb and flow of the political landscape. So for us, what we really like to do is to bring those new technologies and new methodologies with crowdsourcing into the equation so that we can actually bring those forces to bear and do more with less, right? Yeah. And I'll say, all of our workforce is really amazing. NASA has and recruits some of the smartest and best people in the world.
Yeah.
But the world is changing really, really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to keep up, we've got to start introducing new and different ways. And really, that's the biggest challenge because everyone's going to pretty much do their job as if they've done it last month and the month before as far as what they know is effective. And yeah. they don't have the visibility to look outside the agency and really understand what's going on. And so that's where we try to bridge that gap. But it's definitely a organizational change problem.
Do you think the organization is learning a lot from the companies that you're working with? Like, are they taking on any new methodologies that are innovative? I know that's hard to take on in the government, you know, especially when things are a lot of red tape can happen. But I'm wondering, is it moving the dial, you think?
I think it is in big ways. We've done over 400 crowdsourced projects.
Wow.
Some of those have been quite amazing. You know, we tap into crowds like Topcoder, which is 1.5 million software developers, Inocentive, 400,000 problem solvers, Nine Sigma, HeroX, which spun out of the XPRIZE program. I think we actually have something like 18 different crowdsourcing communities that we work with that represent over 70 million people.
Wow.
And when you can do that, you can start to access people that you can't get any other way. So we did a challenge for Homeland Security on the millimeter wave scanners that you go through in the airport to try to improve the algorithm with their new technology. And we ran that on Kaggle, which now has, you know, I think 3 or 4 million data scientists on that platform. And we just got amazing results out of that. I think the detection rate was something like 98% on the reference that we did. And that, you know, compared to what, you know, you see when you go through the airport and every fifth person is patted down with a false positive, that's a big amount of progress. And so we were able to help them get kind of a big bang for not a whole lot of money. And we continue to do that with other agencies and within NASA. And we found a lot of technologies that are sitting over here in one domain that we can kind of pluck out and use over with us.
And how one of the things that kind of keeps popping in my head here is, are you ever presented with challenges that you just don't know? What do you do when you're just perplexed and you don't know? What do you do?
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, the crowd is actually best at those problems that you've had that are really hard and that you've worked on for a long time. And the reason they work so well is we can take those problems and actually pose them to the crowd. And because the crowd is actually made up of people from every discipline, from all sorts of perspectives, they bring all sorts of experience and expertise to bear that you just wouldn't normally think of. We had a solar flare prediction algorithm that we needed to go from 2-hour predictions to 4-hour prediction.
Okay.
And the guy who solved it got us to an 8-hour prediction capability. And he did that because he happened to be a cell phone engineer who knew all about signal processing and extracting signal from noise and all the math with that. But he also had an undergraduate degree from, you know, literally 30 years before in heliophysics. And it happened that the prediction algorithm became possible because he could combine those two things.
I love
he could take the math from the signal processing and apply it to the solar heliophysics.
I have this theory that I think innovation stems from the synthesis of many disciplines. And the idea of being a generalist is something of usually was put down. And I did a talk about it before, but it was about, you know, being the doer of all, master of none. When in reality, you know, that's actually an advantage in today's society. You know, that term was actually built off 1800s when they said, you know, in medieval times, whatever it was, that you needed to do one skill or you die. You know, you're not a blacksmith and a jester. You need to be one of them. Yeah. And now, since there's so many things that require all these skill sets, we need to really understand how we can put these and synthesize these skills together. So I just love the fact that you had somebody on your end to actually prove that theory, you know, on such a large scale.
Oh, it's been proven over and over. In fact, we actually see that happening all over. In fact, part of the presentation I give, I talk a lot about the fact that all of these new technologies really don't apply to one industry. They apply to almost all industries. So machine learning and additive manufacturing and low-cost sensors and Internet of Things and RF and robotics, these are happening everywhere. And what that means is the technology advancements happening often in another domain, and that technology's progressed in that other domain, but it could actually help you over here in space, right? And so if you were to see it, you may not even recognize it because they're using a different jargon. Maybe it's in agriculture.
Yeah.
And so you have to have not only the innovation, you have to have the people that can be those translators. Mm-hmm. And that's where that diversity you're talking about totally comes
from. It's cross-pollination almost.
It's that bridge. It's funny because my background is rather different. Like, I wish I was worked in mobile development in terms of like actual the hardware. But so I did computer science, but I also did dance for 15 years. And I synthesized the two to make, you know, formation management, just like tracking and seeing predictions on if somebody's about to hit each other. And other people like yourself who've spoken to us from, I guess, in about the space industry are like, you know, you could use that for manufacturing. You could use that for like DOD, other things and like, you know, formation. It's just absolutely, like you said, it's the translation of something that we had no idea that has already been innovated, just not in the right place to be used.
It's hard to recognize.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's actually a story I use a lot to kind of bring this point home about a potato chip manufacturer that was trying to do a challenge to get grease off of potato chips without breaking them.
Yeah.
They would vibrate them as they came out of the grease.
Yeah.
And so they posed the challenge. They changed the words to say, how do we remove a viscous fluid from a delicate wafer?
Mm-hmm.
And by rewording it, they appeal to a lot more people than just food production. And the solution was to vibrate the air around the chip at a harmonic that would actually cause the grease to fly off the chip without damaging it. And the person who solved that was a violinist.
Wow.
Wow.
Huh. See, that's just like Eishi Takatsu, I believe that's his name, the engineer in Japan. The bullet train was so fast that it would make a sonic boom out the tunnel. So what he did, he synthesizes to one of the main things he was a bird watcher. So we modeled the front of the train after, I think, the kingfisher, the beak. And so when it dipped down naturally, you know, in the environment, it wouldn't make a sound, right? When it went and got that fish and came out. So we modeled off the train, and a lot of other parts were after bird feathers and wings. And that's why it was so fast. So like, again, I love the fact that the synthesis of things are happening, especially at NASA. I think with technology in general, you don't see just one set of disciplines working together. You know, if I'm going to make medical technology, I'm going to need to know some thing about medicine. If I'm working in dev, it can't just be a coder. You need to have the two, or you make a team that knows everything.
Well, one of the other people that we have on is and she's on our advisory panel, is Commander Chief for the U.S. Air Force. And a lot of the technology that's implemented on the destroyers and the submarines, a lot of that idea came from animals, you know, and came from other industries that weren't even related, not even close. I have a question for you. What is the most risky area that you guys are dealing with now, with the most chips on the line? What is that?
Yeah. So when you say risk, we have lots of different, right? So we're still using rockets to go into space, which you know, those are basically controlled explosions.
Yeah.
We feel that technology has matured and we're feeling better about it, but it's still, you know, you're still putting a whole lot of energy to get into outer space.
Yeah.
One of the bigger risks to going to planetary jumps, like to the moon and to Mars, is that you really have, once you get outside the Earth's magnetic field, you have what we call galactic cosmic rays. And these are much heavier elements that are typically deflected by the Earth's magnetic field. And so we don't have to deal with them on Earth. But they're really damaging to human tissue and can give you cancer and cause all sorts of problems. And right now, we don't have really great solutions that don't require a whole lot of mass to protect our astronauts. And so if we're serious about kind of getting out of low Earth orbit and going out into the solar system, we're going to have to fix that. In fact, we actually ran a challenge on that. We didn't actually get anything that was better than our team because it's very specialized. But the seven finalists were all nuclear physicists from around the world who had tried.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things about crowdsourcing and innovation is innovation requires failure.
Absolutely.
And crowdsourcing is a great way to kind of do that in massive parallel and give lots of people a chance to the lots of shots on goal.
It's a consistent trend with all of the successful people that we interview is failure equals success. So obviously what you're doing here, getting somebody to Mars and not only getting them there in one piece is a whole other gambit. When do you feel comfortable enough to say we're good? Who's that you're responsible for that? That's got to be stressful when you give the thumbs up.
Yeah. And, you know, we have a whole team that works really on the risk posture to understand where are we with regard to risk and when is it okay and what's acceptable.
Yeah.
And we have a really great process with that. And in fact, as the commercial partners are coming on board with SpaceX and Boeing, we've been really working with them so that we have a common kind of understanding of risk and human life risk, especially. And that's something that, you know, everyone's got to be clear. This is not 100% safe. And we are trying to balance the gains of doing exploration with the risk to people.
Loss.
And we recognize if you're really going to be on the edge, that's never 100% sure. You can do what you want to do is you want to do everything you can and still make progress. There have been times when, you know, we as an agency have slid back into a, you know, over safety and minimize the risk too much to where nobody can move, right? And and we've really as an agency gotten better at kind of balancing those with understanding that risk is part of the equation, but we definitely want to put all the safety measures we can in place.
And I have a question that, and I hope you can answer this one, but I'll understand if you can't. When you talk to the astronauts, who ultimately are the ones that are going to be up there, how does that conversation go with the astronauts? They must obviously know that there's a chance they may never return. How does that conversation go?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the astronaut corps are an amazing set of people with amazing talents and skills and experiences. And they know, they understand risk. But they're also part of this process, right? It's understanding what you've got to do to mitigate those risks and then accept the ones that you can't do anything about. We work really hard to make sure we've got lots of backup plans and lots of contingency plans, and we train for that. And the astronauts have a whole part. That's probably what they spend more time doing than anything else, is not planning for the normal, but planning for the for the abnormal, for the off nominal when something goes wrong. And, you know, I think they have a really healthy understanding of what that takes.
Oh, that's so interesting, because I was just at CERN in Geneva, blown away, couldn't understand half of it, mind you. I felt really stupid in there sometimes, but you've got the smartest people and agencies on the planet, and they couldn't be in any better hands. But as you and I spoke, I think a couple of weeks ago on the phone, you know, you were mentioning that you're constantly swimming upstream. Explain to me what that truly means.
Yeah. So whenever you bring anything new into an organization, it meets with resistance. And what you find is people understand what they do and how they do it. And when you come in and say, hey, you know, the world is changing, we need to change the way we do business, that's met with really almost unconscious bias. It's not that people don't want to adopt the latest and greatest. It's not that they don't want the best for the agency. But in an organization, the gut is to resist. Yeah. The gut is to will tell them that there's something wrong with this, that they, that this can't possibly be as good as what I did. This can't possibly work. And a lot of that is, you know, if you came up working a certain way and having success, we often say that yesterday's success is the enemy of innovation for tomorrow, right? Yeah. Yesterday's innovation, because you own it. And once you own that innovation, you're really proud of it. When you start to see something that competes with it, you subconsciously want to protect your baby, right?
Yeah.
And that's just natural. There's actually a case study at Harvard Business School called Houston, We Have a Problem, Dr. Kareem Lakhani put together, that really talks about how initially when we tried to bring open innovation to NASA, that our organization pushed back and was like, no, we can't do this. It's going to screw everything up. And we've come a long way, but it is still, there is still resistance. What we deal with there is we try to really put ourselves in their shoes and be empathetic to that position. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to innovation, we don't say we want crowd members to come and replace your innovation and do your job for you. What we say, and it's true, is we need the best starting place that we can get to with innovation. Innovation isn't a single thing. It's lots of things that get put together. And so you wouldn't start a project with 5-year-old, you know, computers, right? You would start with the latest computer. Yeah. You wouldn't start with technology that's old. So why would you start with ideas that are not the best?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So our innovations are all built on the better starting point. And that really allows our engineers to be the heroes in the equation and to be partners with the folks that are in the crowd helping out. And it really provides a way that the public can participate in this space exploration mission in ways that honestly are so much better than what we've done for 60 years, right? For 6 years, we've said, hey, look at the cool stuff we're doing at
NASA. Classified.
Don't you wish you were us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Well, you don't know what's going on, right?
Yeah.
And so what we find is when we invite the public in, A, find that the people that are passionate about NASA are smart and they have amazing ideas and are often already working on some technologies and ideas out there. And when we give them the opportunity to work with us, we actually have some amazing chemistry that comes together of taking really smart people and seeding them with some of the best ideas out there in the world. And it really creates a larger team around the world.
You know, I think it's because NASA represented, you know, a lot of things to a lot of people. I mean, as growing up, you know, NASA was like this organization that'll take you to the moon. It was all about the future and, you know, and security, right? You know, security against things from the outside, things that we don't know about, keeping the men and women safe, you know, on the ship. So I think the followers, you know, or who are there very supportive of NASA really care. And I think that's what you need in an organization. You're coupling that with caring, proper perspective, and obviously really, really smart people. And I think the fact that you're allowing it to the public is, it changes personally my view on NASA that it's, I'm more trusting now.
I think it's a transparency. Yeah,
it's transparency,
right? Yeah. Which wasn't there before as much.
Absolutely. Well, the other part that I talk about a lot and that I'm working with a bunch of people around the agency is that the world is changing in some pretty amazing ways. The gig economy isn't just this side thing. There are projections that there will be more people working full-time freelance jobs than there are people working normal 9-to-5 jobs in just about 4 or 5 years.
Believe that.
That's a huge shift. And we're already seeing that organizations can't hire the latest and greatest skills. And so what we're talking about internally is how do we navigate this shift so we as the government can leverage that passion that is out there to include people that are smart and have things to contribute, but do it in a way that kind of opens things up from the traditional contracting model, the traditional civil service model? How do we do that so that, you know, in 10 years, we can say, hey, look, NASA's really made up of 1 million different people are making this happen. Some might be making really tiny contributions, and there may not be a ton of them, but they're all kind of helping to contribute in real and tangible ways.
Oh, that's amazing. And I think that's a difficult thing to do because controlling that amount of freedom, but controlling creative freedom and innovation all at the same time is is very tough. Again, coupling it with a normative traditional methodologies as well. Yep. So it looks like you're doing well with that right now, but I'm really excited to see, you know, 4 or 5 years from now where that prediction is happening, what NASA will actually come up with. You know, what are the next new bright and future things? Now, with the collaboration of this crowd, but on top of the private companies like, you know, SpaceX, is there any headbutting or, you know, like problems with creativity there? I would love to just, you know, pick your brain there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. NASA's really, the most people that I know in the workforce are really excited about the partnership with SpaceX and partnership with Boeing and all of our commercial partners. And there's lots of them. Like, in that's just in the crewed area. In the uncrewed cargo area, you know, Cygnus just launched a couple days ago, right? The Japanese have a capability. The Europeans have a capability. Yeah. There's a lot of different spacecraft out there in different organizations. We actually like the fact that that this is being commercialized, because that says that we've now moved to the next level, right?
Yeah.
When there's commercial access to low Earth orbit, that actually frees up our agency to work on the next big thing, right? And so we're not actually dealing with that service. We're buying it. And, you know, I'm sure there was some kind of coming to terms with that in terms of the organization of understanding safety terms, understanding how we've done things. It was several years ago when it started kind of contentious for some people, because you've done this forever and then you're saying somebody else is going to do this. You know, starting to get to that core of change management for orgs. But now we're seeing really some great collaboration going on. We're very excited about where these organizations are taking human spaceflight. And this now frees us up, right? We no longer are going to have a big wedge that's the shuttle program that's taking a lot of resources. We're going to be able to take all of those resources and put them towards going on to the moon and on later to Mars.
And it's amazing because you now can compare other models and like they can fail for you, which is nice.
Does it create a level of competition to constantly be raising the bar?
I don't know if it's competition. I will say that one thing that is very clear in the agency is that, and I don't think this is just our agency. I think this is every organization out there.
Yeah.
There is a battle for relevancy and for keeping up with things. We've never seen technology change rates like we're seeing now.
Yeah.
If you look at the last 15 years and all of the companies that made it onto the Fortune 500, half of those have already gone.
Yeah.
They no longer exist.
Poof.
Half of the most successful companies. The average age of a company went from 60 years in 1958 down to, I think it's less than 18 years just a couple of years ago.
Wow.
That, you know, as an organization that just turned 60 years old,
yeah,
that's a little bit of a concern, right?
Yeah.
Because it says that the very nature of large organizations is changing, and how do we stay relevant? So I don't know that it's as much competition as it's, there's a lot of innovation going on out there. There's a lot of battle for talent.
Yeah.
How do we make that so that we're actually staying on the forefront of what's possible and are good stewards of government dollars in doing that?
Yeah, it's massive, because it's leadership is what NASA is doing. And I think I would like to ask you and see, what would your, I guess, advice for other large organizations out there that are, you know, starting to work with other companies that allow, give off this ability of, okay, you can be creative with this part of our company and, you know, allow them to come in and do that innovation. What would you be your advice to them?
Yeah, I would say we're shifting from a model that's very different than what it used to be. It used to be very hierarchical. We're moving to networks. We're moving from a place where you used to own all of your resources. So you would hire everyone with the idea that they were going to stay in your organization for an extended period of time, and that you had kind of not just the expert that came out of a different, you know, university or whatever, but you actually owned kind of all of the piece parts to that knowledge and could control it. Now, you know, when you hire somebody, their knowledge may only be good for 2 or 3 years before it expires. And
that's it.
The way we have organized or large organizations for training doesn't allow for lifelong learning. It doesn't allow for people to actually keep up with the knowledge that is required and the skills that are required. And so the advice I have actually is kind of counterintuitive, which is at the very time where it feels like you should close and own as much, you really should figure out how to open up a little. Mm. How do you open up to labor? How do you open up to crowd challenges to where you're bringing new ideas in? How do you access freelancer experts that are out there, right? Freelance is all the way in the spectrum of the super expert all the way down to the laborers. How do you utilize that in conjunction with your own workforce so that you actually get that mix of skills, that you're upskilling your own people at the same time? One of the things I've been telling people is you might consider letting your people do a side gig.
Yeah.
And that's, you know,
which is always a no-no, right?
Well, that's what,
I mean, for years it's been like, there's no way we'll allow that because God knows what'll happen. But here's the thing.
Yeah.
If they get out and participate on these platforms, they're probably going to learn something.
Get better.
They're going to learn by doing.
Yeah.
And if you allow it, you can actually put the parameters around it and you can say, hey, don't give away our intellectual property. Mm. You know, here are the guide rails on this.
Yeah.
But by doing that, you actually, it's kind of like if you hold things tightly, it's all going to crumble.
Yeah.
But if you kind of open up a little, you actually have a better chance of infusing the new knowledge, infusing the new ways of doing business.
And that's a, you know, we'll end with this because we're running out of time. But basically what you're saying is what most entrepreneurs that are out of business are guilty for, which is not developing their company and not letting that baby turn into a older person.
Letting it fly.
Keeping it there forever until it just dies. Yeah. So I want to thank you so much. Obviously, who better than the Deputy Director of Innovation, Steve Rader. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
We appreciate yours and NASA's outlook, and we hope we help our viewers as well. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks.
Appreciate it.